accession number 20459, reel 1.
Captain Spencer, reel 1. Could you tell me whether there was any family background of military service?
Yes, my father was a regular army officer in the Norfolks, and he also had three brothers that served throughout the First World War. My father certainly went through Sandhurst. I'm not quite sure about the other brothers. But during the 1914-18 war, which he joined at 18, he lost an arm fairly quickly, at about, I think, before he was 19. Mainly, I think, because he'd ignored the wound and kept in the front line for some time before that somebody insisted that he was treated for his wound. And in those days, they didn't, because of the danger of gangrene, they didn't sort of hesitate to see whether they could sew. It was almost amputated on the spot. Can we... Now, before I go on that, I would all like to say that, and I tend to get a bit emotional, but as far as I'm concerned, my father was the most fantastic person that ever lived. Never successful, never made any money, but was one of those people that just seemed to attract people to him, you know, in all sense and words, so that I find it sometimes difficult to talk about him. That's him, by the way, up there on the right-hand side. Would you like me to carry a bit more on that theme about the father? Okay. Right. Is it ready, or are we still recording? Right. That having lost his arm, he then, for a brief period of time, was seconded to the Royal Flying Corps, as it was then, and served for a number of years, and eventually, after the war, went to Ireland, where he was commissioned with other officers to try and find Michael Connolly. And he married us at about that time, which was considered much too early and too junior rank to get married. My mother moved to Ireland very briefly. And then come 1924, when they were cutting back on the services, he was invalided out.
Was this a result of the Geddes Act?
Yes, it was of the Geddes Act, yes, so when he was invalided out. And a number of things happened. One, principally, went into a timber import-export business, which was starting to do quite well when he was struck down with a very serious appendicitis, and at this stage again it was considered a fairly new operation and not as well handled as it is now. In fact, that the operation was considered not successful, and either that his breathing stopped or anything else, but he was taken to the mortuary and put onto a slab in the mortuary. And it was at least an hour or 2 hours later that somebody brought somebody else in, Harry Moan, that he was then taken back into the ward and fully revived and recovered. But for a great number of years afterwards, he used to have to wear a steel belt to hold his stomach in. He then went into civil flying and was worked out with a fellow called Count Johnson Node, and Amory's son. I can't remember whether Julian Amory or that was a father or a son, who he has two partners for Maidstone Airport. And he worked very hard at this, and it was fairly successful. And they had built up quite a capital in the bank when Amory and this fellow Theory, Count Johnson, no, though I never believed he was a count, went to the bank, drew all the money out and disappeared. Left my father holding it, but he was advised that he should, you know, resign and everything else, but he refused to do this, so they put all the rest of his money into it and worked for about another four or five years to survive, make the company survive, and it then became a profitable game, but of course of no further interest to him. He ran Gravesend Airport at one time as manager, where my wife used, my mother used to do the catering for the Supplin. Percival Gull made his planes there, and I certainly used to go up on a regular basis on the planes. Fokker Wharf used to fly in there because this was the airport that, that they used to use when, what's name. I remember very clearly my brother and I was about 8 or 9 at the time, used to drive an open Morris round the perimeter, hanging out lanterns which mark the perimeter of the airport for him, planes coming in. We used to do a lot of shooting at that time to clear the partridges and things up, which did cause damage. They had a, which is then called, not, it was a skeet shoot, so I became quite an expert with the gun because we, I was able to fire without actually having to pay for the cartridges and everything else. He left for a fair period of time, had another run the jobs, but then rejoined the services before the First World War and into the RAF and rose to a wing commander, doing various administrative jobs, including the time at Air Ministry. Could be stopped there again. As far as the other brothers were concerned, my uncle Edgar was became a captain, or I think eventually major in the machine gun corps, and served throughout the whole of the war. And in spite of so many casualties amongst other officers, he survived to the end of the war, and then became a very successful planter in Ceylon. One other brother died during the war, was killed, but I think it was Somme, and the other brother survived and went into banking afterwards. Could we stop there?
When you were growing up, did you have an inclination to military service or to joining the Air Force as a result of your father's example?
Not initially at all. I grew up in Watford, Castlebury Park Avenue, and at that stage, I don't think I had any particular ambitions to do so. I went to Ardingly College as a very small lad. In fact, when I at 8 years old, when I got there, I was, first of all, weighed, and my weight was below the figure on the chart, so they had to draw another line under it. The height was below the line, so they had to draw another line, so I was feeling very inferior before I started. There was one slight advantage going to Ardingly College. Certainly, it was such a hard regime with cold baths every morning that it totally equipped you for further service in the war, so that everything was comparative luxury compared with the rigors of a boarding school. But my cousin was the housemaster of the junior school, and he helped to teach me boxing, which was the sport that, if anything, I excelled at that time. In fact, that during the whole of the time that I was boxing, I never lost a single fight. And found that being a fairly small stature, that it gave you a degree of confidence that you weren't particularly worried about other larger people. School, however, I seem to be constantly in trouble. We heard once that the Masons were holding particular meetings at the what's-name, and I found out where it was to be held, and I reckoned that I had got up into the roof over and find a position over where they were meeting, and I thought that I would bore a hole in the ceiling to be able to have a look at what was taking place and report to everybody else. This I did, but unfortunately in prodding this hole in the plaster, about 2 feet of it came away and hit the center of the table, which means I had to evacuate very fast.
You did this while they were actually meeting?
This was actually while they were meeting, yes, but they didn't actually on this occasion discover it was me. The other thing there was a very large lake in the school ground, and nobody was allowed to go on it until the masters, in the winter when the ice formed, until the masters had approved it. But there was apparently a tradition for a certain amount of cudus given to the first person that could get across the ice. And so I regularly, on a yearly basis, tried to attempt that. And it invariably meant that I got beaten for the result, because I never quite made it, because I was at the other end. There was always a bit by the trees where there was no ice left, and I'd invariably fall in the morning. And on the last occasions I particularly remember is that I'd be warned not to do it, but I'd told several people that I was going to have another go. And I remember now that the whole of the lakeside was crowded with people, including a number of masters. Nobody bothered to stop me going over. And when you run across ice, there's all this creaking goes on. And I thought that I'd calculated that because to avoid some trees, but unfortunately, the last few yards, the ice was still very thin, so I went in again. But it amazed me I still got beaten for that, but it amazed me that they could have prevented me doing it, but obviously they enjoyed it as much as anybody, I think. Apart from that, there were a number of occasions where I also got into trouble, because there was a particular unpleasant prefect who was in my dormitory. And I decided to give him an apple pie bed, so I pleaded being ill at prep, and went to the what's-name, and the principle was folded a sheet back on itself. And I had put in this apple pie bed toothpaste, boot black, various other horrible various things, and I was just smoothing it all out beautifully before I went into my bed, when the then housemaster, was a fellow called Winnington Ingram, came in and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, the bed looked a bit untidy." He said, "Oh, yes." And he then pulled back the sheet and saw this most fantastic mess that you've ever seen. So I got beaten again for that. I got beaten very frequently for raiding other dormitories or, in theory, talking in your sleep, so that Ardingly College seemed to provide a certain amount of myself against the establishment as a whole. At this time, the war started. I did spend some time in the cadet corps then. But because my father had then moved to Odium Aerodrome, there was a local school called Odium Grammar School, which was a very, very small school, and it was decided that it would take a very long time before I'd have taken a school certificate at Ardingly. It would appear that I wasn't making that particularly good progress, so it was decided to send me to Odium Grammar School. One of the first things that I asked for on the first day was whether they did any boxing, and I was told it all depends. We would certainly arrange something for you. Would you like to come to the woodwork shop at 6 o'clock tonight? Which I duly did, and found that there was sort of a crowd of lads there. And they said, "Oh well, you know, well, we decided that, you know, to test your boxing skills, we'll have a fight now." So I said, "Well, you know, where are the boxing?" "Oh no, we don't use boxing gloves." And then there was a fellow whose name I remember now called Bill Bodger. Bodger, of course, was very much prominent as a Bodger of the Daily Mail, I think, at that particular time. So I said, "Not very keen." So, "Well, you were too scared." I said, "Well, no, not this." Bodger was about very nearly 6 foot, I suppose, and I was still only comparatively 5'6" or 5'7" or something at that time. Reluctant as I was quite happy that I was able to look after myself. And this fellow came charging down the aisle. I sidestepped and hit him one blow in the solar plexus, which upended him into a T-chest. So that his head and legs were sticking out of this, and he was stuck in this thing. So I turned on my heel and went out and thought, well, I've obviously not made myself very popular at the school in my first day. However, the second day they decided that we should have another bout. But by this time, one of the bouncers, a chap called Holmes, had heard of this and said, "Right, well, we'll have this fight in the gym, you know, with boxing gloves and everything else." So that there was I, 2 days at my new school, and already having two fights, which didn't seem very well. So Peter Vickery and I scrapped, but again, he was certainly no boxer, so that it was a fairly uneven contest, and the master stopped it after a period of time. And then with a wink to me, he said, "Well, you know, I'll fight you now." And obviously, it was just a farcical, what's name, he sort of, said that. He said, "Right, from now onwards, if there's any trouble in the school, you'll have to go 3 rounds with Tony Spencer." But strangely enough, from that point onwards, I did make an awful lot of friends at the school, having this initial, school. In fact, after 50 years, I've just recently gone back to the school. Could be stopped.
Can you remember anything about the military training you did in the OTC at Ardingly?
Basically, we did a fair amount of rifle drill and of the very limited stripping and reassembling of the rifle. Otherwise, that it was basically repaids, and I can't really to this day remember any particular strategy or fundamental army training that we received that was of any particular interest in the future at all.
You don't remember any tactical training?
I can't remember any tactical training at all. It was just purely parades, some rifle drills and marching. I can't remember that we went away to a camp in the desert. But it was only, I can't remember when we were first joined the cadet corps there. But my impression of it was that it was not that professional, or even that the school was that keen on it.
Who did the instruction?
No idea. I don't think it was anybody who had previously been in the services. However, at Ardingly, that they were much keener, and we did a number of exercises there. But again, tactics, or even the history of warfare, was really, it was just a uniform, parades, and rifle drill.
Any shooting?
I think very, very occasionally. But we did have blank cartridges, which I used to deploy at various times for explosive purposes.
How old were you when you moved to Odium Grammar School?
At Odium Grammar School, I must have moved 8 5 years at about 13 14. So I was there for about 2 years only.
And they weren't very keen on military training there.
That I don't think that either was either that keen or disliked it. I was inclined to be an active person in the sense that I liked all forms of sports. But I don't think that the military side of it at that particular state, in spite of the basis that my father was and the war was on at this time. But my brother was a Fleet Air Arm pilot. My father was in the Air Force. My mother was doing with the WVS. And I couldn't wait, however, to join the services myself. But because of my father's time in civil aviation, I particularly wanted to be a pilot. But when I did first apply, my eyesight wasn't good enough for the Air Force. So I decided that the Army would be the best choice.
Now, you were at school when war broke out. Did the outbreak of war come as a surprise to you?
Most certainly. I don't think at that particular age one was studying the politics of the occasion. I think that it was not a particular surprise because so much had been talked about it, as to the news was full of it, the papers were full of it, and it seemed an inevitable conclusion that war was inevitable. But of course you didn't at that age appreciate just quite what it all meant. It was still rather a glamorous happening would involve you, and you hoped that you would sort of, you know, go to parts for and everything else, and react Biggles or whoever it might be.
Do you remember whether you had any particular political or military expectations?
I certainly had no political affiliations at that time. I think, like most young people, one was of a socialist approach to life. But I don't mean socialist in the terms of a political party. I feel that one's general desire at that time was to see that there was an even opportunities for people, basically. My views on this has hardly ever altered. I have very little time for just political dogma. I think it is a question of action and what is really best for the people in the whole. I would much prefer to see a combined effort on behalf of all the parties to find some form of coalition rather than be. I think that my views have been the same since, I think, those very early days, really. I was never a political animal.
Did you have any ideas about the way in which the war might be fought? Any ideas, for example, about the way in which air power might be employed, or what sort of tactics or strategy?
I think that it was becoming obvious, especially reading about the Spanish War and other wars, that the ability to control the skies was going to be a very positive feature. But on the other hand, if you'd read a great deal of history, you still need the occupation of the land. You still need to administer the countries that were either going to be occupied or taken and everything else. So my feelings at the time were that the superiority in the air was obviously significant, but it would still be down to the land forces rather than the even the navy to be able to to occupy, and the various places that you or reoccupy the places that have been taken from the country in the whole.
Had you left school by the time you were called up?
I was not called up. I had certainly left school, and I had immediately gone to work. My father was then at Reading with a company called Borden Merley, where I was going to train as a surveyor. So I went to a building site at Burfield. And then transferred to Sir Robert McAlpine, and we were doing work, and my father then moved into Reading. But at this particular stage, I had already attempted to join the forces before I was 18, but had volunteered, I'd volunteered before 18, and I was at Reading before I actually got a notification that I had been accepted.
So you were registered?
So I was registered, and as I was in Reading, which is why I joined the Royal Berkshires, and went to Colchester.
What did you have to do to register? Did you just go to a recruiting office and
just
sign on?
Just go to a recruiting office and give the name and the age, and I think I received the shilling or whatever it was at that time. But I had no more than go to a recruiting office and say my name was so-and-so.
So were you
there was a bit of a delay. I was 18 in July, but it was not to September, although I pressured them to join up to that stage.
Were you attested when you went to the recruiting office?
Attested in the sense that...
Well, attested. Did you swear your oath?
Oh, yes. I had to swear that, I think I did all that at the time, and I think I seem to remember now receiving, right, you're now so-and-so, but... Then notification had to come.
Did you have to attend for a medical examination? Or did that happen later?
I think it happened when I actually joined.
So the Berkshires...
Oh, no, I must have had a medical examination because it was proved then that my eyesight of that medical exam would have been good enough for me to join the Air Force at that stage. But
so the Air Force then had obviously revised their...
Their
requirement.
Possibly, yes.
So you'd registered and volunteered for the Berkshires, and you volunteered for the Berkshires specifically just because you were in Berkshire at the time?
Just because I was in Berkshire at the time.
And you then presumably got orders to report to Colchester for induction and training. What happened to you when you got to Colchester?
Again, very surprising. This again is why the public school, miseries of public school, was a tremendous advantage. I mean, the first thing, we were allocated to a barracks and given equipment which the uniform was not that carefully assessed, but I was fairly lucky in having a reasonably fit of equipment, shoes, uniform and everything else. But we had to fill our own palliasses, mattresses with straw, and initially that we slept on the floor with blankets, and almost immediately there was one or two of the barracks personnel who were regular, were, say the least, rather nasty bits of work, who took a certain amount of delight in making everybody's life misery. And one of the things that then astonished me is that people from obviously fairly poor homes, and where the living circumstances couldn't have been that bright, seemed to be more affected. In fact, there were quite a lot of people I found crying at various stages, they wanted to go home and they didn't know this, that and the other. As I've often found that my voice or the intonation as such did tend at some times to draw a certain amount of ribaldry, but again, because of one's physical fitness and ability to defend yourself, this very, very turned round, and in fact you became a defender of the weak rather than a butt for other people. But those initial days, I think, were very... I hope they certainly don't happen now. But a lot of people, you know, could have been fairly scarred for life of the sort of very rough treatment they received at this stage.
What sort of unpleasantness was inflicted on them?
Some people were considered dirty. So they were stripped and laid in the showers and scrubbed with stiff brooms which would abrase their bodies and everything else. One thing, that there was a degree of physical abuse. In other words, you know, people would be held, their arms twisted, or hair pulled, or this, that, and the other.